having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning, and I feel like saying our first, second, third, fourth, etc., and ninth case of the morning, is United States against Medina and others. So we're ready to hear you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Blagan, and I represent an appellant in this case named Fidelmar Cortez. For the purposes of today's argument, however, I'm going to present the joint argument of all of the appellants, and the argument that we as a group have decided to focus on primarily is the argument and our belief that the defendants in this matter were denied their Sixth Amendment right to an impartial trier of fact because there was a biased juror sitting through trial and deliberations. Before I get started on that, I wanted to note that this argument is tangentially related to some of the other arguments we set forth in our joint brief, our argument that the government shifted its theory from one of a gang drug prosecution to a prosecution or conspiracy centered solely around Thomas Ross. It's also related to our argument that the judge should not have admitted gang evidence in the first place, and it's related to some of the individual arguments that there was insufficient evidence in this matter. Obviously, if you have a biased juror, that impacts whether there was sufficient evidence or not. But returning to the issue of a biased juror, there are three ways to get at this problem, this issue, and in our opinion, all of them, in this case, lead to a new trial. The government, in their brief, indicated that they think because this juror, Mr. Hatow, said that he wasn't biased, that should end the inquiry, and therefore he's not biased because he said so.
And let me just pause on two things as you're winding up for this. First of all, in your opening brief, you really argue that it's question 11 that Mr. Hatow didn't answer honestly. And then in your reply brief, you turn to question 12. And my question for you is, isn't that too late? Question 12 evokes a whole different set of responses from the government. And my other question really is, why isn't it the district court judge's prerogative to decide whether he believes Mr. Hatow after all is said and done, after all the extra hearings, when he said, I believe that I can be impartial?
Well, addressing your first question, I don't believe it's too late. The matter was more than sufficiently preserved in front of Judge Gettleman. I would analogize it to a situation. This court in the past has indicated that if someone raises a 404B objection, for example, and focus on maybe the first two of the five factors instead of the last two of the five factors before the district court, that there isn't a forfeiture because on appeal they decide, after reviewing the transcripts or other matters, that the last two factors are more appropriate or are better arguments for them. So I don't think there's any forfeiture in that regard. And I suppose we can hear what the government says about question 12 today. But I don't think there's any forfeiture. Obviously, there's no waiver that we didn't intentionally relinquish anything. But we had a pretty full argument in front of the district court, in front of Judge Gettleman on the matter. What I think happened here, at least from the district court's perspective and ours, is the district court entered his judgment shortly. I think it was a matter of about 20 minutes after the hearing in which Mr. Hatow testified. He didn't take the time to review the transcripts. He didn't take the time to compare what Mr. Hatow now said for the very first time to the other voir dire questions, although we all knew we were talking about gang issues, and he didn't take the time to review, frankly, what Mr. Hatow said in his testimony.
Well, I think that's being a little unfair to the judge.
He
made his decision. Let me ask you this. What if on voir dire you would have asked a juror, do you like street gangs? And the juror says, no, I don't. Would that be grounds to challenge that juror for cause?
Possibly on its face, but it certainly would have led to...
It would?
I think so.
So you'd have to like street gangs to be acceptable as a juror?
Well, certainly someone could say that I don't have any opinion on street gangs. I mean, I understand your question, and it's a problem that defendants run into in every case. Nobody likes murderers. Nobody likes drug dealers. Nobody likes corrupt politicians either. So if you ask that question, in any case, you're never going to get the answer that that a defendant may hope for. That is, I am completely unbiased about any of these matters. Obviously, nobody likes street gangs, except maybe the members themselves. But
you just said that you could probably excuse.
You probably could move to excuse that person for cause. But the real issue is, would additional questions lead you to information that would result in a strike for cause? And here, unequivocally, it would have. And I'm going to get to it in a second, but the controlling case on the matter of a false question during voir dire is McDonough versus Greenwood, a Supreme Court case. And they said the next question, after you find a false statement on voir dire, the next question is, would that have led to a valid basis for a challenge of cause? Now, they didn't say, would it lead to a winning basis of a challenge for cause? They said a valid basis for a challenge for cause. Of course, you would have a valid basis based on somebody who says, I have a problem with street gangs. You would at least have a valid basis to ask for cause, and you certainly would ask more and follow-up questions, which is what we were denied the right to do here. But more to the point, the things we learned about Mr. Hatow after his false statements on voir dire led to information that certainly would lead to a challenge for cause and a winning challenge for cause.
Mr. Blake, I'm interested that you read Greenwood so narrowly. I mean, the court does say would have provided a valid basis for a challenge for cause, but then in other cases, too, they've said what we really care about is did the jury that actually sat operate as an impartial body? Were they impartial? And I'm not sure I interpret would have provided a valid basis as just you could have made the challenge without getting sanctioned for a frivolous challenge.
Well, that's the way that I read the language, but I will concede that other cases, certainly in other circuits, have then gone to the question they've kind of just jumped right into, is there an implied bias here?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, would it have been a valid and winning
basis
for cause?
Winning.
Yes, that's how the courts have examined it. It doesn't seem to me that that's what Greenwood was indicating or McDonough was indicating, but that is how courts have examined it. The problem, I think, with that analysis is that implied bias is a ground for a new trial in and of itself. You don't even need to have a false question to a voir dire, a false answer to a voir dire question, so why would they set up an analysis that is already separate and into itself a valid basis for a new trial? In that sense, I don't think it makes much sense.
What is the false answer that you're asserting this juror gave during voir dire?
There are two false answers, Judge, and one of them, admittedly, is a subjective question. So the juror's answer can only be proven false by other evidence. But the first one is this. You will hear evidence in this case about alleged involvement with street gangs. Will this evidence affect your ability to be a fair and impartial juror in this case? He said, I have no problem with that. And that's the subjective question. We believe that, aside from his answer, every other piece of evidence in the case indicates that he was not telling the truth when he said he could be fair and impartial in this case. This is a juror who wrote a secret note to the judge. He was the foreman of the jury. He wrote a note to the judge saying, please keep this note secret, or words to this effect. If you can't do that, then don't read it at all. Don't share it with the lawyers or the other jurors. He then indicated in the note that there were jurors who were bifurcated along racial lines in their decisions as to whether to find for guilt, guilty or not guilty. And he then goes on to say some jurors were divided into groups of jurors who understand the evidence and jurors who don't understand it. And they indicated at that time that for two of the defendants, they were right at that moment hung. They couldn't come to a decision. So we have a juror who obviously had some more than usual interest in the verdict, we believe indicated by the secret note to the judge. Then we have this same juror, the foreman, afterwards asks for a meeting with the prosecutors. And I should say insists on a meeting with the prosecutors. This is another area where I think the record indicates that he was not telling the truth. Mr. King, former Assistant United States Attorney John King, gave a proffer to the court as to what happened during this Hatow government meeting after the verdicts. And he said that Mr. Hatow insisted on having the meeting and asserted some right as a taxpayer to come to the meeting. When questioned in the post-verdict hearing, Mr. Hatow said, oh, no, I asked if we could have a meeting, and on the first time I asked, they said, oh, absolutely. from the very beginning of his hearing, of his testimony, he was equivocating about what happened. I think it's a fair reading of the transcripts to say that when he later, when one of the defense lawyers started asking him, well, didn't you say this to the prosecutors and didn't you say that, he realized the prosecutors had let the cat out of the bag as to what he talked about and started at least coming a little bit closer to what actually happened. So we've got this juror who, the secret note, asks for a meeting with the prosecutors afterwards to take what we've termed as a victory lap with them and to seek some sort of acknowledgement for obtaining the verdict. But more importantly, then,
before you move on to the more importantly, I mean, it just does seem to me that Judge Gettleman learns about all of this, right? He knows about the proffer from AUSA King. He certainly hears Juror Hatow's testimony. And it seems to me Judge Gettleman, in the final analysis, resolves this by saying, you know, this guy has had his problems, you know, with the defacing of the windows and the graffiti, but that's kind of life, as it were, life in the big city. These are urban problems that we all experience. And he resolves these kind of contested different currents of evidence in a way that is not favorable to you. He resolves it saying, I think Mr. Hatow in the end was able to be impartial. It's hard to win on that kind of an appeal.
Well, it's an abuse of discretion standard.
Right.
And there are some cases that say, that the judge is given deference and it has to stink like a five-day-old dead fish or something like that. I hate to mention it. But I think this does smell like that, for lack of a better term. And the reason I have a lot of respect for Judge Gettleman. But what I think happened here is he didn't. Well, for one, we had just finished a two-month trial, and nobody, every present company included, wanted to try the case again. But I think he didn't analyze the issue closely enough, and he didn't analyze it in the context of question 12, and didn't give counsel time to review the record to, I don't think we can. And he said for the first time, let me go to question 12, and I think things will become clear as to how we believe Judge Gettleman abused his discretion. Question 12 is, whether you or any member of your family or a close friend belong to any group that defends or opposes gun use or ownership, deals with drug abuse, deals with issues involving street gangs. And for the first time at the post-verdict hearing, after having answered this question, I have no problem in voir dire, Mr. Hatow told us that he was a member of a group of businessmen on the west side of Chicago that dealt with issues involving street gangs. And I think that happened because he was trying to deflect the attention from himself as being somebody who had trouble with street gangs. He was saying things like, well, it wasn't me personally. I'm not the person who, on my own have a problem with street gangs. But as a group of business owners, we had trouble with a street. We had issues relating to a street gang, and we dealt with them. It's his word. He uses the word group. If you look at the transcript, you'll see that there's no defense lawyer forcing that word into his mouth. That's his word for it. And in fact, he even goes on to say that this group had to petition the city of Chicago to get what they wanted, which was a barrier around their businesses somehow to keep these troubles away.
But, you know, Mr. Blegen, it seems to me, this is why I'm concerned about question 12 only coming up in the reply brief. The phrasing of the question, belong to any group, could have, I think, maybe most naturally suggest, you know, are you a member of the NRA or something? And then, in your joint reply brief, you've reproduced, which was helpful, the language you're worried about. And he's saying what was felt by the building owners as a group, which might mean like all of us. I'm not sure that you have to see this as an organized group to which one might belong.
Well, that's why I mentioned the earlier part, which is not reproduced in the reply brief. There's, I think it's on page 14 of the transcript of his hearing. That's where he talks about having to petition the city as a group to get this barrier that they put up. That, unequivocally, I think, puts this as an actual group in his mind, not just a group of people in the, people in general. This is a group of businessmen who petition the city or apply to the city or get city approval to put up a barrier.
So if I and my next-door neighbors go collectively to the city and petition, we're suddenly a group?
I think so. If in your mind you are a group, and in Hatow's mind that they were a group. It was his words that he chose, not ours. I mean, it sounds to me like you think we're picking at nits here, but I don't think we are. The question 12 doesn't say that it has to be a group with an official title or a group with a name, or a group that has membership dues and all kinds of other things. It just says any group. And he certainly belonged to that. But inherent in all of this is what I think you'll find as the utter equivocation of Mr. Hatow at the post-sentencing hearing. This is a man who has the letters MLDN and a pitchfork on his building. And he hems and haws, despite the fact that he tried to wash it off several times. It was there before, during, and after the trial.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Does the record reflect when that appeared?
Yes. He said it appeared 6 months prior to the hearing that we had.
Would
have been before the trial. So it was there before, during, and after the trial. He tried to get it off many times, couldn't get it off, and at the hearing, he attempted to say that the letters were something different. And admittedly, it's in the sort of script that whatever graffiti artists use, that they don't, you know, use the kind of things you might use in an English composition. But I think it's clear to the naked eye what the letters are. But as far as his equivocation is concerned, he tried to say that, oh, I thought maybe it was somebody writing I love you to his girlfriend in Spanish, which is absurd. I mean, I don't speak Spanish, but I assume they use vowels like we do, and you can't say I love you with four consonants. It's absurd, and he equivocated, but what I think Judge Gettleman missed was the direct contradictions. Leave aside question 12 for a second. The direct contradictions between what Mr. King told us and told the court and what Mr. Hatow said at the hearing. And he didn't have a transcript of what Mr. King said, and perhaps he didn't remember it, and I think that's what led to the abuse of discretion here. Mr. King said that Hatow told the government of what he said thought Mr. King thought was a strange story during that meeting, and that is that the gangs took over his business area. Those were the words that Mr. King used. It's a little tricky how you can see that in the record, but Mr. King, when he's giving his proffer, we asked him to put something in writing. The government declined, and the judge didn't order them to do it. Mr. King says that in our motion for a new trial, to which we attach memorandums of defense lawyer conversations with King, that Mr. Tunick, one of the lawyers here, had it right. Mr. Tunick wrote in there that King told me that Hatow said the gang came and took over the area. And that's what happened. And in his testimony, Mr. Hatow denies that. He says, I never told him that. So we've got a direct contradiction between what an assistant United States attorney is saying and what this foreman of a jury is saying. This man knew what we were getting at when we were asking questions. He had consulted with a lawyer prior to coming to the hearing. He knew exactly what we were getting at, and all of a sudden the gang came and took over, turned to, oh, maybe it was a group of kids who might be in a gang who were around there. It was absurd. He also changed his story about the sort of things that were done to his building. He initially says at the hearing there was some problems. There was some vandalism. It was minimal, and I think we dealt with it in an okay way. Later on, Mr. Robbins, one of the other lawyers who was cross-examining him, says, well, but what did you tell the government about the vandalism that was done to your building? Suddenly the story changes, and it was a marked escalation from day one. There was as much vandalism as you can imagine. This man had broken windows. He had somebody he thought try to damage the brick siding to his building, damaged the sign indicating what his business was, and he thought had a break-in. And instead of conceding that what he had told the government was the case, that is, the gang took over, he equivocates and says, oh, it was just a gang of kids. One thing he didn't equivocate about, though, was this membership in this group of building owners. And had he said anything about that, maybe, I don't know if it's a group, but certainly I am together with business owners dealing with gang issues, we would have asked more questions, and it would have inevitably led to at least most of the information we now have, and he would have been dismissed for cause, without a doubt. And
you said in your brief, oh, go ahead, Karen.
I don't know why that follows, that he would have, even if everything you said is true, why, if he then would have been asked the typical question about, now, could you still put all this aside, your personal experiences here, and decide this case, because he didn't know any of these defendants fairly and partially based on the evidence. And if he said yes, I don't know that would have been a challenge for cause, a successful challenge for cause.
Obviously, we disagree, and I'll tell you why. I mean, first of all, we have to assume that he would answer the follow-up questions truthfully. So if he truthfully said, if we said, well, what was your business problem with relation to gangs? And he said, the gang came and took over the neighborhood. That's probably a good enough basis for a challenge for cause. If he had said truthfully, I also have the letters MLDN and a pitchfork on my building right now, that probably would be a basis for, forget probably, that would be a basis for a challenge for cause. And no matter how much he protested that he could still be fair, it would have been a successful challenge for cause. The man was literally fighting with the very same gang over which he was presiding. He was a trier of fact at the trial. And that's analogous to cases that have found, you know, sufficient bias in the past. That is, cases, this court has dealt with cases where, you know, a juror happened to work for the U.S. Attorney's Office, cases in which bias has been found where jurors had, you know, similar experiences to the ones that were on trial. There's a case where jurors were burglarized during the trial of a burglary slash murder. That certainly would have led to a valid basis for a challenge of cause. And I think it certainly would have been granted. I think the white light indicates I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will come back when everybody else is done.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Blagan. Mr. Duesberger, are you the next one up?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Roger Duesberger. I represent Juan Hernandez in this appeal. I will address issues 1 and 3 in our briefs. Issue 1, the evidence was insufficient to support the jury's finding that Juan Hernandez joined the charged conspiracy. At trial, in its opening statement and the two closing arguments, and in independent representations to the district court, the government made dealing with defendant Thomas Ross the focus of its case, the sine qua non of membership in the conspiracy. Its argument provided a roadmap to convicting the defendants in the context of the court's instructions. It consisted of 3 points. 1, Thomas Ross was the head of the conspiracy. 2, he supplied all the drugs. And 3, buying drugs from Ross made one a member of the conspiracy. We're not contending that the government's argument was evidence or supplanted the district court's instructions, but its description of the conspiracy, repeated over and over again in its opening statement and closing arguments, as it was, very likely influenced the jury in its deliberations and verdict. In fact, it did influence the district court, which in its drug quantity memorandum adopted the government's position that involvement with Thomas Ross was more important than involvement with the MLD gang.
But, you know, looking at the indictment, I don't see this as such a crisp switch, you know, from an MLD conspiracy to a Ross conspiracy as you're portraying it, because the indictment actually says that they're both part of the conspiracy. Paragraph 2 says it was part of the conspiracy that they were members of or affiliated with the MLD street gang, and paragraph 3 says it's further part of the conspiracy that Thomas Ross was doing these various things. And so from the get-go, they're telling you that this is an interrelated thing, and if the emphasis switches some from MLD to Ross, I'm not sure that makes it inconsistent with the indictment.
No, and we don't contend that the indictment was somehow amended. But we do say that however you look at the evidence, whether Ross was the centerpiece of the conspiracy or whether it required some combination or whether there was a necessity to have a distribution or intended distribution through the gang, still the evidence was insufficient to support a jury verdict against Hernandez. With respect to the Ross evidence, Hernandez, the only evidence before the jury that Juan Hernandez ever bought any drugs from Thomas Ross at any time consisted of recorded telephone conversations during a 35-day period, March 6th through April 10th, in a conspiracy the duration of which was about 7 or 8 years.
But why is that so important? I mean, surely there are ways of being a member of a conspiracy without being a direct purchaser from the ultimate supplier of the conspiracy. Some people are middlemen, some people are lookouts, some people organize, you know, corners.
And that's correct,
roles.
Your Honor. But there's no evidence that Juan Hernandez was a middleman, lookout, supplier. The only evidence was that he bought marijuana on 5 days during this entire period from Thomas Ross. There were actually six purchases, two on one day, the final day, April 10th. And based on the court's indicia decisions on the indicia of conspiracy, these six possible marijuana buys from Ross failed to constitute membership in the conspiracy. There was obviously no actual agreement, but buying wholesale drugs does not constitute agreement. Repeated drug buys does not constitute agreement. Also missing were other important factors. The time period involved was short, 5 days during a 35-day period.
But the government wholly disagrees with your characterization of this time period. I mean, basically, they go all the way back to the 1990s, even the 80s, but that's not part of the... I don't want to get into that debate. Let's just say early 1990s when the conspiracy begins. And we have evidence that he's high enough ranking in the MLD that he's organizing these sections.
Well, actually, Your Honor, that's wrong. There's no evidence that Mr. Hernandez was a high-ranking member of the MLD gang at any time during the charge period of the conspiracy. The only evidence that he held a rank during or in the gang was Aguirre's testimony that in 1987 and 88 he was a section manager or section leader. There were 25 sections of the gang at the time. So he was a middle manager in 1970 or 87 and 88. After that, as we mentioned in our reply brief, he was incarcerated for about 2 years or more in the Illinois Department of Corrections. And Aguirre's testimony never goes beyond that 1988 period in terms of leadership. There's no other leadership evidence. A lot of argument by the government at trial and in its brief, but when you examine, and we did for about seven pages in our reply brief, when you examine the government's arguments and their citations and actually look at the record, which I did very carefully many, many times, there's no evidence. Now, he did say in his confession or the statement that they took after his arrest that he had been a minister, but the government never asked him when and what the duties were.
So I take it you think that this evidence that the government's citing at the bottom of 55 and the top of 56 in its brief just doesn't check out.
I'm sure.
For example, they say in another call with Jose Rodriguez, Ross explained Juan Hernandez's position. Ross told Rodriguez that even though the zone, the Rockwell and Potomac section, was Juan Hernandez's, they still did the business together. And then there are other references.
That's a misconstruction of what was actually said. And I cite what was said in our reply brief twice. Ross was saying to Rodriguez, the zone is yours, meaning Rodriguez's, not the zone is Hernandez's. That was the government's interpretation, and I think an erroneous interpretation. We quote the actual language. The transcript, I think, is before the court. So he said that he told Rodriguez, the zone is yours, bum, meaning Hernandez, and other guys hang out there. And then he talked about doing business. But in the context of this call, it was unclear what the business he was talking about was meant to be, whether it was with Rodriguez, any of these other people that were referred to. So he certainly was not saying that Hernandez, Juan Hernandez, was the leader of this section or the potentate or whatever.
Well, in the business together, what about a little bit further down the same paragraph when Jose Roman is asked to work as security for meetings among Ross and David and Juan Hernandez?
Jose Roman was asked to work security by David Hernandez.
Right, but if the three people, if Ross, David, and Juan are all at the meeting, why do we care who asked him?
Well, there's no indication, there's no evidence that Juan even knew that David asked Roman to work security. There's no evidence that they were standing talking about anything other than the sports pages of the paper. There's no evidence they were talking about drugs. There's no evidence they were holding guns. There was no evidence that they were holding drugs, bags of suspicious-looking substances. Roman was not even close enough to hear what they were saying. There's no evidence that Juan Hernandez was part of these meetings or get-togethers, whatever, more than once. And in fact, these were guys who lived in the neighborhood standing on the corner talking. There was evidence in the case that the MLDs were fearful of the other gang in the neighborhood, the Latin Kings. There was evidence of, you know, warfare between the gangs. So sure, Roman is working security. Someone asks him to stand and watch out for the other gangs. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this had anything to do with drugs or guns. So I think the evidence in that respect is very thin. Moving on briefly to our third issue, which is the... and on sufficiency, in terms of the indicia of what a conspiracy is in U.S. versus Thomas, and I'm going over a little bit to just touch on... I will just move on. Our next point, which is the issue number three. The court found that the conspiracy was responsible for 13 kilos of cocaine, crack cocaine. There's no evidence that Juan Hernandez was dealing in crack, buying crack cocaine from Ross. There's no evidence that Juan Hernandez was trafficking in crack cocaine in the early 90s, 91, 94, 90, even 98. There's no evidence in the 1988 period that crack cocaine was involved. In his conversations with Ross, which is really the centerpiece of the government's case, his conversations are primarily about marijuana.
Right. Those conversations are about marijuana, which is why I come back. I mean, I think it's all going to be tied up with what we think of the conspiracy point, because if you can show that it's reasonably foreseeable to Hernandez that the group as a whole are involved with crack, that's enough, right?
Well, there's no evidence that he was hanging out with these other people, that he was involved in meetings or conversations with these other people. There is distinct evidence that he had conversations with Ross about marijuana. There's distinct evidence that he was arrested in 91 and 94, I think it was, or maybe 93, in possession of powder cocaine. It was never tied to the conspiracy. It didn't involve crack. In 98, there's sporadic evidence as well. There's no tie to the conspiracy. There's no indication that any of the drug substances he was said to have in his possession were distributed or intended to be distributed through the MLD gang. There's just no evidence of that. In fact, with respect to the marijuana and Ross, there's no evidence of what Hernandez did with it. There's no evidence he distributed it through the gang or even intended to distribute. They never even talked about that. So I'll wind up here. And it's
okay.
So, thank you.
Fine. Mr. Tunick.
Your Honors, my name is James Tunick, and I represent Leslie Chambers, both in the district court and before Your Honors. I know it's a very high burden to come before this court and seek reversal based on sufficiency of the evidence, but everybody struggled with this issue in the lower court. The jury struggled for 5 days with this issue. As you heard, they were divided. Just from Mr. Hatow's testimony at the post-trial hearings, they were divided 7-5 on racial lines. The judge struggled with this issue tremendously. He held a separate hearing on the sufficiency of the evidence as to Mr. Chambers, and he said, Mr. Chambers seems to be the one most on the outside of this activity. He was held accountable for 200 grams. There was the conspiracy was involved that he that Judge Gettleman found as to other co-defendants was 13 kilos. And the reason was because there was five cooperating witnesses in this case. There was Louis Franklin, Jose Aguirre, Lynn Johnson, Pablo Navarrete, and Jose Roman. Not one of those individuals mentioned Chambers in any way, never saw him, never testified to a co-conspirator statement of any other defendant involving Chambers. In any respect, I didn't even ask any of those witnesses a single question. There was 18,000 calls recorded on five target phones and surveillance. Those consensual recordings began in 1997. The Title III wiretaps began in October 1998. Chambers' voice was not identified until the spring of 1999. 6 days of phone calls were played.
What about the Stacey Dalton testimony?
Stacey Dalton was given immunity, and her conduct was she lived with Mr. Chambers. Her conduct was very similar to Mr. Chambers. She purchased drugs from Mr. Ross and sold them to her friends. Likewise.
Doesn't she testify that Chambers acknowledges that Ross was supplying both of them?
She acknowledged that Chambers supplied, that Ross said Chambers supplied, that Chambers said Ross supplied him. But she did not acknowledge the time frame. And the only time frame that we have is the calls that were made involving two real drug transactions.
Why is that the only time frame?
There was never an individual testified as to a time frame involving Ross and Chambers.
The government, again, I mean, I suppose I'd have to go back to transcript page 2215, but the government says Dalton received cocaine from Chambers as early as December 1998, and then no one's mentioned yet this famous drug ledger or whatever it was, you know, the spiral notebooks, but those seem to create a time frame, too.
Well, that was when Ross was arrested, and Chambers owed him $1,100, according to the government. It said less. Whether it was the less Chambers, yeah, surely that's circumstantial evidence that less owed him money. But the most important thing is that there is no harmless error as to Mr. Chambers. If you find that there was an error as to Mr. Hatow, there is no harmless error. The evidence was so slight as it involved only one witness who received immunity. There was 4.5 hours of testimony as to him, and really involving maybe two, possibly three drug transactions. Judge Gettleman found him accountable for 200 grams. If there's any error in this case as to Les Chambers, this case should be reversed as to the conspiracy. And I would like to save my final time for rebuttal.
Sure. Just a clarification point. Are you raising a sentencing issue?
No, because of the limited amount of drugs that Judge Gettleman found.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Joseph?
May it please the court, my name is Nancy Joseph, and I represent Gerald Pittman. Your Honor, this morning I'm going to address Mr. Pittman's sole individual issue, that is, that the district court erred in not allowing in not reopening the evidence to allow Mr. Pittman to exercise his constitutional right to testify in his own defense. Generally, there are four factors that courts look at in evaluating the whether the evidence should be reopened for a defendant to testify or for the evidence to be reopened at all. And looking at all of them, I believe they all weigh in favor of Mr. Pittman.
But Ms. Joseph, I'll tell you that this strikes me by analogy. It's only a loose analogy, so don't get too technical with it, to somebody who decides to change his mind about pleading guilty, because there's an exchange between Judge Gettleman and Mr. King and Mr. Pittman's lawyer when Mr. Pittman's lawyer, Mr. Thies, says he's changed his mind, decided he doesn't want to testify. The judge explains that. Then Mr. Thies says, perhaps if Your Honor, just for the record, maybe we could have him on the record as to saying he does understand. And then the judge directly says, Mr. Pittman, do you understand what I just said about your right to testify or not to testify? Pittman says, yes, I do. The judge reiterates, all right, it's your choice not to testify. Pittman says, yes, it is. So he has this on the record. And so now later on, Pittman is coming back and saying, well, actually, I didn't really mean that. You know, I wasn't honest with the court when I said, yes, it really is my decision. And that's where the analogy strikes me. You know, he's said under oath, the judge has given him an opportunity to say, actually, I really still do want to testify for whatever reason. You know, it really doesn't matter. If he'd wanted to testify, he had the right to do so. And I really think it's in that context that the judge is evaluating all of this.
I understand the analogy, Your Honor, but what the analogy fails is when looking at the totality of the context. Mr. Pittman, all along, very early on throughout the trial, expresses his desire to testify. Trial counsel brings up the issue of whether his proffer is going to be admitted or not. And then
but
the day comes.
That was always without that was against his counsel's advice, though, wasn't it?
That was, Your Honor.
Part of the factor here that it was always his lawyer had recommended that he not testify.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is part of the context as well of what Mr. Pittman is against in exercising his right to testify. He says, I want to testify. What happened when he says that? He's part of a multi-defendant trial. The other defendant's attorneys get up and blow steam. No, you can't testify. You're going to sink our ship. This is a disaster. You're going to take us down with you. Mr. Pittman is against all of that, all of the drama. In addition, you have his own counsel saying it's against my advice. When Mr. Pittman is asked on the record whether or not he wants to testify, I think the context is they return from a recess. Mr. Pittman is in court with his counsel. There's an off-the-record conversation between Mr. Pittman, the attorney, which tells us, I think, that this was not something that was settled. There's a last-minute discussion going on between the two of them. Then the counsel announces, Mr. Pittman, Your Honor, no longer wants to testify, and the judge has this inquiry with him, and he says yes. However, the additional context is, Your Honor, is the pressure that was going on in the courtroom. Not only in the courtroom, it makes sense that if the attorneys were so expressive, were so dead set against Mr. Pittman testifying, that the defendants were as well. And during the breaks, where's Mr. Pittman? In the bullpen, in the holding cell with the other defendants. So when he comes back, and announces after the close of the evidence, Judge, I want to testify, I believe, given the context of the drama that was displayed in the courtroom, the trial judge should have made a further inquiry instead of just, well, you don't want to testify. Now you want to testify. The judge should have made a further inquiry as to why are you changing your mind now. As to his excuse that he gave. He said, I was feeling pressured, Judge.
He doesn't even go into all these more dramatic reasons that he comes up with later. And yet Judge Gettleman explores all of these things. And I guess I'm not sure. I mean, I find it hard to disagree with Judge Gettleman that if Mr. Pittman had then, whenever they reconvened, maybe it would be 2 weeks later, maybe it would have been sooner, if Mr. Pittman had testified, it seems to me that he really would have been opening the door to a lot more testimony. There might have been rebuttal. There might have been, impeachment evidence. There might have been all sorts of things. I think it's kind of open-ended how much more of the trial there suddenly would have been.
I think those are legitimate concerns, but those concerns, I believe, were not weighed against Mr. Pittman's right to testify. I think the court only focus on the concern of, well, if I reopen the evidence, what could have happened, the can of worm, and not equally weighing that Mr. Pittman had the right to testify. And on that point, Your Honor, the concerns about the delay, the concerns about possible rebuttal and so on, they all could have been addressed with a limiting instruction. And also, there was no closing argument yet. The jury had not been instructed yet. So the co-defendants, the government, who was not objecting, could have addressed Mr. Pittman's testimony during their closing arguments, in addition to co-defendants addressing Mr. Pittman's testimony during cross-examination. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will now hear from Ms. Haling.
Good morning, Your Honor.